Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's the 8th of September 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, and Phil Bishop, editor of the Construction Index, a daily online news service. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David. Nights are getting closer, aren't they?
They certainly are.
Up in the dark, and there goes summer, eh?
Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness now.
Who's that a quote from?
That's Keats, John Keats, Ode to Autumn.
You are so educated.
So, Phil, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, I think we should talk about the top 100 ranking that you've done of the top 100 construction contractors. So our annual look at who's up and who's down, the latest financial results. And it always makes fascinating reading to pore over columns and columns and columns of numbers and statistics.
Yes, yes. It certainly appeals to a certain type of reader, I think. Maybe it's not for everybody, but it's. I think it is a fascinating sort of snapshot of the 100 biggest contractors by turnover, that is, registered in the UK. These things are always slightly approximate when it comes down to it, because you have to define your terms. You know, what is a construction firm? What do we mean when we say they are a UK construction firm? A lot of them, I mean, the elephant in the room being Balfour Beatty, of course, has huge operations outside of the UK. And you could say that the UK isn't the main focus of its activities. You could say that about Lang O'Rourke as well, I suppose, and a few others.
Well, there are all sorts of health warnings that we need to issue with this, as we do every year. Your point about, we include Balfour Beatty's global numbers, but the likes of Vinci and BAM and Skanska, we only include their UK numbers.
Yeah.
The other things to note is that some of these companies, actual construction contracting, might be quite a small part of what they do. They might have much bigger property development businesses or house building businesses or materials supply. And then there are a couple of Googlers in here I noticed, which I don't think of construction companies at all, but I suppose if they put down their industrial classification at Companies House, they put the construction code down, then we kind of are obliged to include them in the rankings unless we start reading them out. So we've got the elevator companies, Otis and Coney, in there.
Yeah.
And we've got HomeServe, who are, to my mind, nearer construction than
Well, they're sort of maintenance, aren't they?
Yes, but we used to have, I think, Mighty in there, who
we did a
bit of building maintenance, but mostly other stuff.
Yeah, exactly, and that is always one of the problems. I mean, we've talked about Carillion many times, and of course, one of the things that characterised Carillion in the later years was its shift towards services and away from contracting. And I always thought of Carillion as being the old tarmac construction firm, and therefore a contractor, a builder of roads and things like this. And of course, while it was still doing a lot of construction work, when it went under, it was also, as you famously described it, emptying bins and serving school dinners. So nothing's always cut and dried. So you have to take some of this with a pinch of salt. But I still think, to come back to our original, I don't want to talk the issue down, because of course it's our annual top 100, and it's the highlight of the year in many ways. It does provide a fascinating look at what's going on in UK construction once all the caveats are out of the way. So was there anything particularly that you noticed this year? I should mention, by the way, that I shouldn't really take credit for the top 100. Obviously, I edit the magazine and I edited this article, but it was researched and written by Steve Mennery, who is a regular contributor of ours. So I should just give him a heads up there.
I was just to say, Steve has done an excellent job with this.
Yes.
I suppose the headline is, as his intro, it's surprisingly not that bad. The total aggregate revenue for the year, and most of them, people's financial years vary, but quite commonly it's the year to December 2020. It is the calendar year 2020.
Yeah.
There are one or two who are a bit behind. So, for example, Interserve, we've got 2019 results there rather than 2020. And Eurovia have got 2019 results and so on. But broadly, as a snapshot, what we're saying in the COVID year is that overall revenue for the aggregate revenue was down less than 5%.
Yeah.
Total turnover for the top 100. Only Balfour Beatty managed to of the top 10 managed to increase its turnover. So a lot of people were down. Most people were down, but not that much.
No.
So it wasn't that bad. And the only really basket cases were people who were basket cases before anyway, which I'm, you know, Kia have made or lost before tax about £500 million
yeah.
over the past 2 years. And Amy have had a couple of very bad years. They've broad terms lost 100 million last year and the year before.
Yes.
So I don't think of them as COVID victims. I just think they are where they are, if you like.
Yes. I mean, they won't take very kindly to being described as basket cases. I mean,
Kia,
certainly.
Okay.
No, but I think we know what you mean. We know what you mean. Yes. Kia's had a pretty torrid time. But I noticed, I think a couple of weeks ago, it was reported that Kia has actually returned to profit. I mean,
Costain.
I'm talking about Costain, aren't I? Yes. Sorry about that.
That was last month, Costain put out their first half figures.
That's true, yes.
They're back in profit. They've had a difficult time too. There's a few companies who have had 2 years of pre-tax losses. Galliford Try, Costain, Multiplex. Yeah. These are companies who have two successive years of losses. And that, you know, that ain't good, frankly, of course. But yeah, as I say, overall, it's not as bleak as I thought it might be. I mean, we've said this before, when we started talking about what COVID might do to the construction industry 18 months ago or more, I think I used the word carnage. I was expecting carnage. And
yes, I think a lot of people were.
It's not been as bad as we thought it might have
but
been.
But we knew. I mean, it became sort of... it soon became fairly clear last year, didn't it, that that workloads were not necessarily suffering. People were still letting contracts. And the industry got back to work quite quickly after the first lockdown. And we were all saying rather, you know, we didn't want to scotch the whole thing, but people started saying, well, you know, things don't look too bad for the construction industry. And I think that is borne out by these turnover figures. But the profitability position has changed dramatically, hasn't it? Because overall profits were down by 82% compared to last year on this year's top 100. So these companies, you know, they've managed to keep workloads fairly high, and they're still quite busy, but they're not making money
as
like
much
they were.
Money.
No, they weren't making as much money as they were last year or the year before that. And I think that's a trend that we've certainly noticed on the magazine, because in the monthly sector focus that we produce, looking at different specialist areas of the industry, that has been a fairly clear trend that even if turnover, sort of bulk revenues, have remained fairly buoyant and the industry is clearly still busy in particular sectors, almost all of them have shown a reduction in profit, and in some cases a very sharp reduction in pre-tax profits. So it does, you know, that the picture is very clear of a busy industry, an industry which still has work to do, but just isn't making a lot of money out of doing it.
Here's the key number that you're referring to. The bottom line is that in our top 100 last year, the average profit margin, I think it's the pre-tax margin, was 2.3%.
Yeah.
This time around, 0.8%.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of companies that would be quite happy to make a 0.8% margin in construction. some people,
it's not unusual.
A lot of people don't manage that, but we generally think of 2% as sort of industry standard. Yes. for construction. So we're short on that. But I don't find that. I mean, again, I think that's higher than I might have expected.
Really?
This time last year. That still people, you know, if you're making 0.8% margin on £70 billion, you're making money.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I suppose it's positive, isn't it? You can't argue with that. It's interesting also to look at some of the things which Steve has pulled out of these figures. Looking, obviously, he's had a look at the effect of the COVID pandemic and the lockdown and the various measures introduced by the government to mitigate the impact of that. And I think it's fairly clear that we won't be seeing the net result of our response to the pandemic until probably this time next year. Because, of course, a lot of these companies, I think, I can't remember who it was. I think it was Glenigan, the sort of analysts have worked out that something like 30% of contractors in the UK actually used the furlough scheme and the government support, which was available to them. And a lot of them are still, you know, relying on that. And that's kept employment numbers up. You know, it might be that's going to come to an end. And I wonder what the effect will be once that safety net has been removed. Even, you know, below the top 100, you know, self-employed people in the construction industry, apparently the amount claimed on the self-employment support scheme amounts to nearly 2 billion. Oh, hang on a second. Is that million or billion? I can't even read my own handwriting.
Anyway,
a lot of money. Must be billion. Yes, it is. Nearly 2 billion claimed on that. So, again, you know, that will skew the figures. Another factor which I noticed, which was quite interesting as a result of the COVID measures, is that there was quite a reduction, a very sudden reduction in profit warnings from companies as a result of this. Steve got some interesting figures from Ernst & Young's strategy consultancy, which is called EY Parthenon. Not an outfit I'd ever really heard of before, but they looked at this and he explains that the 40% of listed construction companies issued a profit. 40% of listed construction companies issued a profit warning in the 12 months to the end of first quarter 2021. But there were only 3 alerts in the first half of 2021, and only one, and that was NMCN, North Midland Construction, in the second quarter. So there was a sudden drop off at the beginning of this year in a number of profit warnings. And I guess that is a result of companies taking advantage of the government support, which was available to them.
Partly that, and partly there was the first lockdown. Everything stopped for a period of time,
yeah.
Some sites longer than other. And then they got back to work again. And they're not just back at work. They're busy, busy, busy.
Yeah.
Shortages and inflation notwithstanding. I mean, there are other problems that the industry faces, but lack of work doesn't seem to be one of them.
Yeah, well, that's true. And another thing, another plus, unexpected plus of as a result of all this, is that apparently people are paying more promptly now as a result of this because the money is there, and they feel they do, presumably, I'm just surmising here, they don't feel they've got to hang on to other people's money for quite so long because they can always borrow a bit more from the government. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but yeah, the late payment has reduced, or has prompt payment increased. I'm not sure how really to couch that, but yeah, quite interesting. Let me see if I can find the figures. Build UK has been gathering these figures, and Steve got hold of those. And for the first half of this year, 32 leading main contractors settled with subcontractors within 34 days, which is 11 days quicker than when trade body Build UK first started collecting payment data in July 2018. You might not have expected that to happen.
No, I think a lot of that is because Build UK is publishing the data. It's not people are suddenly getting more generous or got more cash sloshing around that they want to get rid of.
They just know that people are watching them.
It's that people are watching them. The yeah. government have been pushing it, and Build UK is pushing it, and it's, there's been a big drive to get. In fact, I think in the, a lot of framework contracts and public sector contracts, it's a condition imposed upon them that they have to pay their supply chains in time, in a prompt manner.
Yeah, but even so, you know, quite remarkable during during a plague year anyway. Did anything else particularly grab your attention for any particular companies, perhaps?
A few companies I'd just like to briefly talk about. One of the few risers, I mean, most people are either down a bit or occasionally up a bit, but Winvic, up about 10%, roughly speaking, in turnover, and made a 3.3% profit margin. And Winvic, as we've talked about before, I mean, they're big into beds and sheds is how they describe themselves in loose terms. So it's built-to-rent accommodation or student accommodation, and these great big, you know, Amazon-style, Ocado, whatever, distribution warehouses that are cropping up all over the country. And they've just found a real sweet little market. And they're not, we might think of that as sort of the easier end of construction, but as we've discussed before, Winvic are quite at the front end with some of the technology that they've been employing. We've talked about them before. So I'm enjoying seeing the health of the success of Winvic.
Yeah, I think they're an interesting company and definitely one to watch. But that leads me on to another another trend which comes out of the top 100 this year, which is the performance of regional contractors. Because obviously you'd expect on all the big sort of infrastructure projects and redevelopments and all that kind of thing, you'd expect to see the big national tier one contractors, you know, being active on the ground in the various different regions. But there are some regional contractors which are big in their area, but they seem to be ceding ground to the big nationals. Again, two-thirds of it's the way Steve has looked at this is he's looked at the regions and, you know, who are the top 10 contractors in those regions. So the southeast, southwest, northeast, northwest, Midlands, Scotland, the rest of it. And you might have expected in the past to see some big regional players dominating workloads in those areas. And you would have done, but their influence seems to be on the wane, which I think is an interesting trend. You tend to find that it's the big boys who are getting all the work there now. And if I can find a few figures here.
Well, I'm looking at the table you use. I mean, it's not surprising, for example, that eight of the top 10 contractors in Northern Ireland are Northern Ireland players.
That's right.
Because it does tend to be a discrete market. Scotland, half of them are regional Scottish players.
And in Wales, to a lesser extent.
And in Wales as well, yes. But when you talk about sort of, you know, let's London, the northwest, southeast, southwest, nine of the top 10 players are national players.
Yes.
You know, yes. Balfour Beatty, Morgan Sindall, Keir and so forth. And I'm particularly surprised about that by the southwest. I thought the southwest was more regional than that.
And so did I. I mean, I live in the southwest and I've got used to seeing, you know, distinctly southwest based businesses active in the construction industry, not just contractors. I mean, certainly contractors, but also house builders, material suppliers and things like that. But I mean, we've seen with, for example, builders merchants, there's been a lot of consolidation in that sector. Yeah. And that's becoming less regionalized and more centralized. You know, our local building material supplier, Raw Gammon and Baker, which is the go-to supplier in the southwest, certainly in my part of the southwest, recently bought out by a national. There's one company which is quite influential in the southwest still, and that's Midas, and they do both development and construction, and they're pretty active, but they're struggling a bit. Another factor to come out of the top 100 this year is that Midas posted a loss for the first time in 40 years this year. So, you know, it's under pressure. And yeah, you see certainly, you know, infrastructure projects in the Southwest tend to be dominated by the big major players. But it does seem to be a trend.
I think part of that, possibly, is down to frameworks. The fact that big companies, you know, big companies, regional operations,
yeah,
they get onto a framework for, you know, a SCAPE or Pagada or one of these sort of public sector frameworks, and then they're there. That's sort of not guaranteed, but it's pretty much money in the bank. You've got your foot firmly in the door, and if you don't get on the framework, you're excluded for the for
that's to right.
be 4 years, yeah. 5 years, 10 years, whatever the term is. And we've talked before about social value and how it's supposed to be the local players who gave more back to the local economy by virtue of employing local people and having local offices and everything else. Were supposed to be the social value metrics are supposed to give them a higher score and push them up the chain, but they don't have the, I suppose, the marketing teams and the social value professionals on board to wave the flag for that in the way that, you know, they're doing all the social value stuff. They're just perhaps not as slick at selling it.
No, that's true.
I tell you, the two regional players I was sorry to see slip out of the top 100, because I still think of them as major contractors, Beard and Stepnell.
Yes.
They were only in the 90s in terms of ranking last year, but they're, you know, 150-odd million turnover companies, and there are a lot of people higher than them who, if we just talk about pure contracting, don't do as much actual building.
I was going to say, if you took out Connie and Otis, then they'd be back in, wouldn't they?
Yeah,
Beard
yeah,
and Stepnell.
Yeah.
It depends how you want to cut it, really. But I was surprised that they fell out of the top 100 this year. They only made it for the first time last year, though, so maybe we shouldn't be surprised. I think of them as being fairly big players, actually. I mean, they're not small. I mean, the top 100, by definition, they're not going to be small.
But a lot of the top 100 have got their turnover is inflated by the fact that they're in property development or something which has a lot of money that goes through their hands without ever really landing in their bank account.
Yeah, yes, that's true. Again, it depends how you look at it. Did you look at the rich list? The richest people in construction. I think that's always quite interesting.
There's a lot of nonsense.
Well, we do this every year. We find out.
I know, but in my experience, people who you think are very, very rich have often got huge liabilities. They may have a big car, but the bank probably owns it. now, obviously, top of the list, Lord Bamford. I mean, the people in this list, okay, they're rich and proper rich. But the Sunday Times, the people who do the Sunday Times rich list, I mean, it's been shown over and over again that there's an awful lot of, you know, holding a wet finger up to the wind and trying to decide what the valuation may be. And you get a lot of Companies House listings where it says, you know, who owns this company? It says, well, so-and-so, shareholder of more than 50%. Well, you don't actually know whether they own 99.5% of it or 51% of it by Companies House filings often. And therefore, there's an awful lot of guesswork goes into it.
Yeah.
But there's no doubting these people are very, very rich. Although there's someone I never heard of before on this list. Apparently, tell me about Yelena Baturina.
Well, I'd never heard of her before. She's number three on the list. But Yelena Baturina is... This is basically... what we've tried to do is to look at the Sunday Times rich list, the richest people in the UK, find out which of those derive their fortune from construction. Lord Bamford comes top, even though, I mean, you could argue that he's not in construction at all. He's a manufacturer. He doesn't build anything. He makes diggers and all right. Then you could say that...
He builds a few factories.
Well, I suppose so. Yeah, he does that.
No, he's a client for construction.
He's a client. But I mean, he's in there because JCB is in the popular imagination virtually synonymous with British construction. So he's an honorary member, I think, of the construction industry. John Bloor, of course, is a second one. But his Bloor Homes, of course, I can't remember. Is he the chap who owns the Triumph motorcycle?
He is,
business?
But I can't believe Triumph generates huge amounts of money for him.
I wouldn't have thought so.
I haven't looked at Triumph's accounts, but.
He's in house building, and that makes a lot of money.
He's always in that list. It does.
But Yelena Bacharina, let's get back to Yelena Bacharina. There's no reason why anybody amongst our readers or listeners should know who she is, because she's Russian, Moscow born. She has a company, which I think she inherited from either her father or her ex-husband or her deceased husband. I'm not quite sure. A Moscow-based construction firm called Inteco, I don't know how you pronounce that. It doesn't sound very Russian or English. And she also has a company called Hitex based in Germany, which manufactures membranes. So definitely involved with construction, but not really with UK construction. The reason she's in the list is that she's registered as a UK resident. So I guess that means that she is a member of the UK construction family, but even though she doesn't actually do anything in the UK, as far as I can tell, she's got a wealth of about £1.2 billion. Though
it's interesting, though, the richest people in construction, according to this list, it's mostly from Bamford notwithstanding, it's mostly from house building.
Yes.
John Bloor, Steve Morgan of Redrow, the McCarthy family from McCarthy and Stone, and they've now got what's the new business that they've got? The sons have got. It's called. Is it?
I can't remember.
Is it Churchill Retirement Homes? Is that them?
Yes, I think it is.
David Wilson. Is that Wilson Bowden?
And
or is it David Wilson Homes? Not sure.
Well, he was Wilson Bowden founder David Wilson. So I know, and house builder Charles Gallagher. He's another one.
Yeah, you tend not to be on this list by, well, actually, I think there are probably some very, very rich contracting owners. Ray O'Rourke's not on this list. He must have a bob or two, mustn't he?
Yeah, he must be. But I think Ray O'Rourke's fairly canny. I think, you know, if you've really got a lot of money, if you are very, very rich, then nobody, quite honestly, knows exactly how rich you are. The richer you get, the more muddied the waters become, I suppose. Ray O'Rourke is a very reticent person, I think it's fair to say. He doesn't like publicity. He rarely gives interviews. And I think we could all respect this, doesn't really want people knowing too much about him. So we've got no idea how much money he's got. I bet he knows, though. And he's not telling.
Talking about Lang O'Rourke, David, of course, what we should mention just quickly is the big news. Do you see the interview that Ray O'Rourke gave to the Financial Times?
Yes.
A couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
End of August, Bank Holiday Monday. We're going to float the company in a few years' time, he said. He wasn't hugely precise, but he said 2024 we will be in good shape.
Well, I was very surprised to hear that.
Yeah, interesting. I was rather hoping an employee ownership trust. That would have been a nice
we're big fans
way
of that.
To lead the show. Yeah. Anyway, so that's Lang O'Rourke's big news.
Good.
Anyway, well, we've said before there's always a lot of opportunity to make money in construction, and if anyone's just finished at university or just finished at school and thinking about whether to go to university or get a job, there are many worse places to look for a career than in construction.
I think if you've got an entrepreneurial streak, you've got a good business mind
and an appetite for hard work.
Yes, and an appetite for hard work, then you will succeed. You don't have to have a university degree. You don't have to, well, I suppose it does help if you've got an MVQ or something like that. Most people, I think, if you look, a lot of these CEOs, they come up through the tools, don't they? They do start at site level and work their way up. A lot of it is through pure common sense.
There are always two types, aren't there? There are those who get to the top because they've done a good job, and those who get to the top because they're accountants.
Yes.
And they've run the business from head office, and they understand how the money works inside out.
Yeah.
And always used to be said that when times are hard, you put an accountant in charge, and when times are going well, you put a more sort of marketing-y salesperson mm-hmm. in charge. Yeah. I don't know whether that still holds true, but that used to be the way things worked out.
Yeah. I think on a regional basis, looking at, you know, if we're talking about SMEs, you know, smaller and medium-sized companies, you know, there are thousands of businesses out there which are doing really well, even now. Little regional contractors, house builders, specialists, who basically started off as apprentices, you know, learned their trade, yeah. and then thought, I could do this in terms of, you know, running a business, and then start running a business, maybe employing a few of their mates. I mean, both you and I have spoken to countless people who have come that route in the past, haven't we? And, you know, there are loads of people doing extremely well all around the country who have got into the industry like that. You don't have to be one of the top 100 to be a successful construction business.
One of the old entry avenues for young entrepreneurs has slightly closed off, though. There was a time about 20 or 30 years ago where you could purchase a dilapidated old run-down flat somewhere for really not very much and get 100% mortgage from the bank, do it up, flip it, buy a slightly less dilapidated one, and you're on the property ladder and you're a property developer.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you're in the building game.
Yes.
I don't think that door is existing quite the same way that it did. Do you?
No, I don't. I think that's because of the property market. The property market is very volatile. And
well, volatile is no bad thing. There's money in volatility.
Yeah, but it goes up and down, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you have winners and losers, but you know, if everything's flat, then it's harder to make money.
Yeah. But I don't know. Why would it be any more difficult now than it was?
Well, because you cannot get a dilapidated, rubbishy old flat would be 100 grand rather than 20 grand.
Oh, I see. Yes.
And,
yes,
and exactly. You can't get, you know, the banks aren't queuing up to throw money at you.
Yeah, that's true. But then if you look at plant hire, you could buy yourself a dilapidated old JCB 3CX with, you know, umpteen thousand hours on the clock and go around helping out local builders on their site as an owner operator. And again, if you can see which way the wind is blowing and you build up some good relationships, get plenty of work, you buy yourself another digger, get somebody else as an employee, and you're a plant hirer. And so many plant hirers have started off like that and built up big businesses. And I remember once Grove Cranes, which are now, I think, part of Terex, aren't they? Or are they Manitowoc?
No, part of Manitowoc.
Yeah, well, Grove Cranes took me to see a little company in Wigan that had been buying their new all-terrain crane. They bought several of them, quite a big order. And they say, you know, these guys are going somewhere. You know, they bought our new 40-ton all-terrain crane, which is the newest thing on the market. And I thought, well, you know, they would say that because they've just launched this machine and now somebody's bought one. They want to tell me all about it.
Yeah.
So I went up to this rather scruffy yard in Wigan.
Did you meet three brothers by any chance?
Three, yes, all with the same surname, which was Ainsco. And there they were. It was nothing to write home about, quite honestly. There was the crane, nice and shiny and clean, and they showed me around it and all the rest of it. And these three boys were very pleased with their new crane and said they had plans to buy a few more. And well, as they say, the rest is history. They bought more than a few more. They bought lots more. And,
mostly Lee pair, though. They didn't stick with Grove for very long, did they?
That's true. Yeah, so, and that's how these buildings, I mean, if I remember right, the Ainsco brothers didn't launch that business. That was their father who started off. But I mean, it was still a very small concern when they took it over, but they just, they turned it into something completely different. So if you've got the native wit and the ability, and as you say, if you're prepared to work hard, you can do well in the construction industry. And, you know, there are plenty of stories out there of companies which have done that.
Does that bring our discussion of the top 100 to a conclusion?
I think it probably does.
It's the 8th of September 2021 yes. today. Coming up, we have the 20th anniversary, can you believe, of the 9/11 attacks on the USA. And do you remember where you were when you saw
yes,
this
of course
or heard
I do.
About this?
I mean, it's what one of those. It is one of those events, isn't it? I mean, for our parents' generation,
it was JFK, wasn't it?
JFK yes. was shot. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember very vividly where I was because I was in my office and I was working, and my mother-in-law phoned up and said, "Have you seen the news, dear? An aeroplane's flown into a building." She said, "Oh, yes, it's on the television. You better have a look." And so I did. And of course, she'd understated it, if anything, which is unlike my mother-in-law. And so where were you, Phil?
Well, much the same as at my desk working, and someone came in and said, "Blimey, an aeroplane's flown into the World Trade Center in New York." And I assumed it was sort of I had a picture of, you know, King Kong holding Fay Wray, one of those little sort of tiger moths. Yes. I didn't imagine King Kong was there, but one of the tiger moths, some little biplane had accidentally, you know, clipped its wing against the side of the building.
Yeah.
I hadn't at all cottoned on that it was a jumbo jet filled with fuel that was, and the whole thing's about to come toppling down. So, like you, I thought, okay, that sounds bad, but carry on with my work. And it was only driving home, listening to the radio, I realised this sounds big. Yeah. And then got home, turned on the rolling news coverage, and it was quite a shocker.
Yeah. Well, anyone who was old enough to remember that at the time, it really was. Because of the instant news coverage, I mean, it was an absolutely beautiful day in New York then. Wonderful weather, clear skies. And, you know, even 20 years ago, we had 24-hour news and it was all over the news everywhere instantly. And it was, shocking is an understatement, but it was astonishing. Yeah, it was a defining moment of our lives, I suppose.
For me, more memorable was the day a couple of weeks later on the 28th of September when I actually went to the site of the World Trade Center, to Ground Zero, to report on the clear-up operation.
Right.
And I still have hundreds of photos in front of me from not just of that day, but ones that I was given by the iron workers and the people involved in the clear up. And I've just been rereading the article that I wrote at the time. At the time, I was editing a Crane magazine, the same one that you had edited before
oh, yeah.
me. And I happened to be in the US that week, and it occurred to me that, hang on a minute, I should be going to New York. I know the guy that's leading the effort on site for all the lifting machinery on site, and I know he's busy, but his story needs to be told. So I rang him up and said, "All right, yeah, I knew there would be no point going earlier, but they'd been there for, you know, the clean-up operation had been going on for about 3 weeks by this stage, and or a couple of weeks at least." And he gave me a couple of hours of his time, showed me around the site, and explained how it was all set up. And I'd forgotten till rereading this that there were British construction contractors were heavily involved in the clear-up. AMEC was one of the four. There was the whole area of Ground Zero, which is just, unless you see the pictures, I couldn't begin to describe it. But AMEC had one quadrant of it, and Bovis had another quadrant. And I'm just looking at this article, which I wrote. I think it was Turner and Tully was the fourth. So Bovis and AMEC, both British. And working, or supplying the machinery for Bovis and AMEC, was a man called Jimmy Lommer, who is the guy who invited me on site, who is the owner of New York Crane, and the also had a company in his own name, Lommer. And the logistics of getting the huge, great, heavy machinery into this war zone, basically. The war had been, but there was just, like, so much damage everywhere. And trying to get the heavy machinery in, set up these 100-metre lattice booms, and lifting stuff off. And initially, it was had been for the first few days chaos, because obviously you wanted people, the people, volunteers scrambling through the rubble to, looking for bodies, for survivors, hopefully, and all of that. And then you had the people trying to set up machinery to lift off the buckled and melted steelwork and concrete and everything off the pile of it's more than rubble, but it was just being there and seeing the work that was still going on at this stage was very, very stirring.
Well, surely it could have only just started. I mean, only 2 weeks after the event. I mean, two enormous towers had collapsed. And we've all seen the picture of the debris and the dust and goodness knows what else. I mean, where do you start with a cleanup job like that? It must be bewildering.
I want to quote something I put in this article at the time. Five factors were at work. Firstly, it was a scene of a crime, not a regular construction site. So you had to be sensitive to the fact that it was a scene of a crime. Secondly, what you say, the sheer scale of devastation, you didn't quite know how or where to make a start for the best.
Yes.
Thirdly, the Emergency Planning Centre, which was set up after a bomb went off at the World Trade Centre 8 years previously, was actually inside the World Trade Centre. So that had gone. You'd lost the Emergency Planning Centre and all of that. Fourthly, all the surrounding structures could fall any moment. You didn't know how safe anything above ground or below ground, how safe anything was. So the sort of element of treading on tiptoes, and can you even drive a heavy crane over the ground here? And fifthly, such was the outpouring of goodwill and everyone rushing to help, that there were more people making themselves available to help than anyone could organise and manage.
Right.
So there was this kind of onslaught of help at the beginning, and it took a couple of days for an organisational structure to emerge, for it to be, you know, the four contractors were given a quadrant each, and the big crane companies came in and were given bits of the site divvied up to bring all their big machines in. And once that settled down, it then did become more regimented, a professional operation. But people were putting in, I mean, Jimmy Loma was he only lived about half an hour away from the site, and he brought his camper van, Winnebago or whatever it was, home, onto just the edge of the site. And he was there on site for about, he didn't go home for about 2 weeks, even though he only lived half an hour away. And he was getting a half hour kip here and there. Kind of, I think he told me he slept something like 4 hours in the first 5 days or something.
My goodness.
And this was typical. Other people were just bunking down on camp beds. There were, you know, 22 hour days were being put in routinely by all the you know, it's all the fire brigade get huge credit, rightly so, and they're sort of the heroes that the movies have been made about, the firefighters, the fire rescuers, but actually the riggers, the steel workers, the people who are operating and setting up the cranes and attaching loads, they were risking their lives in just as much, as often, working just as hard. And they were kind of the unsung heroes, and that was kind of what I was setting out to do in my reporting of that event, was the other people who were moving hell and earth to
absolutely
try and get things back going again.
Have you been ever tempted to go back and visit the site? Because of course it's been completely redeveloped now.
Well, the last time I went back was before it had been redeveloped. It had been completely cleared away. I would guess it would have been maybe 15 years ago I was there last, maybe 12. And yeah, it was a clear site. And there were still people. It was not a tourist attraction, but a place of pilgrimage. I mean, people would want to go see the site where it had happened and just, you know, read the signs that are around and bow their heads for a few minutes.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, my daughter had to go to Chicago, this is a couple of years ago, for a conference, and came back via New York, and obviously made a beeline for Ground Zero. And she said the same thing. She said, you can't go to New York and not visit it, really, because, you know, as a visitor, it is such a, I hate to use the word iconic, but it is iconic of our time. It's not, because, I mean, it's going as a tourist or as, you know, it's not a ghoulish thing to go and visit Ground Zero, because, of course, there's nothing ghoulish to see. It is a way of going there and just sort of reflecting, I think. You go and visit that place and you just think about what happened there 20 years ago. And it's pretty overwhelming, I should think.
I don't think you should have any qualms about visiting places of tragedy like that, in the same way that the you know, there are concentration camps in Germany and Eastern Europe, yes, which are, as you say, it sounds trite to call them tourist attractions, but they have lots of visitors all the time.
Yeah.
And it's important that we remember.
Remember, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, 20 years, I can hardly believe it.
Flies, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Right, on that note.
Right, on that somber note, yes, indeed.
I think that's another episode of Reconstruction wrapped up.
I think it is.
As ever, you can contact us, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can subscribe to this podcast. If you're not a regular listener and you found us for the first time, you can find us again just as easily and sign up, get it regularly to drop into your listening device. And we'll be back again next week. So from him, David Taylor, and me, Phil Bishop, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.